From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
The New York Observer team were the first outsiders to witness the clandestine initiation ceremony of Skull and Bones, the secret society that produced two presidents named Bush.
Today, we'll look at two societies. One, the top secret society that George W. Bush and his father were a part of. And then the Federalist Society, a radical right-wing legal group, among its members, some of the most influential officials of the Bush administration. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Pharmaceutical giants dropped a lawsuit today against a South African law that could provide cheaper generic AIDS drugs to millions of Africans, ending an international battle over patent rights and profit that deeply embarrassed the companies. The lawsuit was seen by human rights groups and AIDS activists as a landmark battle in the effort to secure medication for the 26 million people in Africa infected with HIV. The law could give South Africa the power to import or produce cheaper generic versions of patented drugs, including expensive antiretroviral drugs needed to treat AIDS. Activists who packed the Pretoria courtroom erupted into cheers and songs when an attorney for the 39 drug companies told the judge that, quote, the application is withdrawn. Mark Haywood of the Group Treatment Action Campaign said of the companies, who include giants Merck, Bristol-Myers, Squibb, and GlaxoWelcome, there's no doubt that they've received a black eye. He said, I think it will embolden people in developing countries around the world to stand up for medicines that are affordable. The dropping of the suit appeared to be an outright capitulation by the drug companies. The South African health minister said South Africa did not agree to any deals regarding the law, which passed but was never implemented. The drug companies also agreed to pay all the costs of the case. Here at home, in a crucial ruling on the role of race in legislative districting, the Supreme Court yesterday upheld a long-disputed North Carolina congressional district against the accusation that the 47% black district was the product of an unconstitutional racial gerrymander. The 5-4 decision, which overturned a lower court's finding that the state's 12th congressional district was unconstitutional, provided much-needed guidance to state legislatures and lower federal courts that will soon be dealing with a nationwide round of redistricting as a result of the 2000 census. The message of Justice Stephen Breyer's majority opinion was that race is not an illegitimate consideration in redistricting as long as it is not the, quote, dominant and controlling one. In this news from Mississippi, with the possibility of an economic boycott looming, Confederate heritage groups called on people to accept Mississippi's decision to keep its state flag with the Confederate emblem. The NAACP raised the threat of a boycott yesterday after voters rejected a proposal that would have replaced the Confederate symbol on the flag with a cluster of 20 stars signifying Mississippi's admission as the 20th state. The NAACP used the tactic against South Carolina, where a Confederate flag flew for decades atop the State House dome until it was moved to the front of the building. The governor of Alaska said he'll propose a hate crimes bill this week and create a commission to combat what he called, quote, a dangerous corrosion of Alaska's social fabric. The measures are in response to a January paintball attack against at least a dozen Alaska natives by three white youths. Police confiscated a videotape that was made during the attacks in downtown Anchorage. And this news from Cambridge, Massachusetts, about 50 people started a sit-in at Harvard University to demand pay raises for some university employees. The protesters said the university is the nation's wealthiest, but pays more than 1,000 of its direct and subcontracted employees as little as $6.50 an hour. They want the university to pay all employees at least $10.25 an hour. From Hawaii, the union representing faculty members at the University of Hawaii reached agreement with the state yesterday on a 2-year contract, ending one of the 2 strikes that have kept students from kindergarten through graduate school out of class since April 5th. The settlement with the University of Hawaii Professional Assembly gives all union members more than $2,300 raise for the first year and a 6% increase the second year. Nevada Governor Kenny Gwynn signed a bill yesterday that would stop the sale of Nevada power plants, halt deregulation, and bail out struggling utilities with a new rate system. The Senate and Assembly gave the measure final approval earlier in the day and rushed it to the governor. The bill was crafted to keep Nevada from suffering from a power crisis similar to California's. And the Environmental Protection Agency said yesterday it would postpone until February a decision on how much arsenic should be permitted in drinking water. But agency officials said a new rule would definitely call for a reduction of at least 60% from current allowable levels. The move bears on one of the most politically delicate decisions of the Bush administration, a decision to set aside, at least for now, a Clinton-era rule that would have reduced the arsenic standard by 80%.
L'altre verem per nostre spoglia, non per qualcuna sendre bestia, che non è giusto aver ciò compositore. Vi le strascineremo a per la mesta serra, saranno i nostri corpi appesi, ciascuno al fondo l'ombra somereste. Avarice, hanging, self-destruction. Io feggi, io betami, le mie case. Make my own home, be my gallows.
Let My Home Be My Gallows, featuring Sir Anthony Hopkins and produced by Hans Zimmer from the original motion picture soundtrack of Hannibal here on Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. It's the primal scene of American power, of Bush family values. For 2 centuries, the initiation rite of skull and bones has shaped the character of the men who've shaped the American character, including 2 presidents named Bush. And last Saturday, April 14th, for the first time ever, that long secret rite was witnessed by a team from the New York Observer, a weekly in New York. Joining us is the leader of that team, reporter Ron Rosenbaum. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thanks, Amy.
Well, you were the first, even before this piece, to really go into detail, to bring the American public an expose of this secret society called Skull and Bones. Can you talk about its significance?
Well, I've been following it for a quarter century, ever since I was an undergraduate at Yale and living next to it. I was actually a classmate of George W., and I was fascinated by the legends and the rumors of the rituals that went on inside this secret society. And also, if you study American history, you find that it functions as a kind of key network of power and influence, the American equivalent of the British Old Boy Network. It's produced 3 presidents, including William Howard Taft and the 2 Bushes. It's produced secretaries of state. It's produced the people who made the decision to drop the bomb on Hiroshima, to get us deeper into Vietnam, to invade the Bay of Pigs. The people who really shaped how the American powers exercised in the world and in America. And it's not that it's like some Kabbalistic conspiracy. It's the way power works in America, which are these informal bonds of friendship, of comradeship, and the bonds that are forged for the first time in this strange initiation ritual in this Egyptian Gothic-like tomb in the Yale campus. And no one has ever seen what went on in this initiation ritual until me and several other people, including some brave souls who were at Yale, actually managed to videotape it with night vision video cameras.
Well, we're going to find out about that and find out about some of the more disgusting aspects of the initiation, like making fun of Abner Louima. But before, explain what Skull and Bones is, how it got its name. This weekend, actually, Yale is celebrating its 300th anniversary, and both the former president, George Bush, will be there, while his son is up at the Summit of the Americas in Quebec City, and also Bill Clinton will be there. But George Bush is an alumni, as you were saying, of Skull and Bones.
Skull and Bones is an almost two-century-old secret society that was founded as an offshoot of a German secret society, and its goal was to train young men for leadership, and now admits women. But and every year, at a ceremony known as Tap Night in April, 15 of the best and brightest or the most talented and powerful or promising from the junior class are tapped, as it's called, as selected to become members of Skull and Bones. It's not a fraternity. Fraternities are sort of mostly college-based. This is a lifetime society membership whose activities, whose network of influence continues way beyond college. And in their senior year, they undergo these strange confessional psychodrama-like bonding rituals. They lie in a coffin, one at a time, surrounded by the 14 others in the crypt in Skull and Bones, and they give their personal autobiographies, they give their sexual histories, all in a way to sort of forge this kind of alliance between them that lasts a lifetime.
They're lying in a coffin when they say this?
Yes.
Naked?
I'm not sure if they're naked. I think at one time they were, but now that it's co-ed, I don't think they do that anymore. But the death imagery is important. What it's designed to do, Skull and Bones, in part at least, is to take sort of very promising young members of the elite and to give them a sense of lifelong mission and direction, that they have a purpose in life. Much like George W., who was, pretty much a slacker in college, a slacker after college, but nonetheless, he was inculcated with the sense that he had a mission to become a leader. And that's the Skull and Bones values, that you're not just an average Joe, you're destined to exercise power and to be sort of the steward of American power in the world.
You write that for nearly a century and a half, Skull and Bones has been the most influential secret society in the nation, and now it's one of the last. And among the things you expose is that members get, what, $15,000 each?
Well, it's not clear. When I was first investigating it back in the late 70s, there was talk that if members needed a chunk of money, either to take a grand tour of the world and get experience in international, beyond America, or if they were, a member became low on funds and perhaps he might be tempted to sell the secrets of society, he could always count on Skull and Bones, which is a fairly wealthy institution, to bail them out, to give them money. It's not clear whether there was an automatic grant of a certain amount.
You say Bonesman Henry Stimson, Secretary of War under FDR, a man at the heart of the American ruling class, called his experience in the tomb the most profound one in his entire education.
Yeah, the people who have been through the Skull and Bones experience, and not just Henry Stimson, but the founder of Time Magazine, Henry Luce, people like Averill Harriman, Secretary of State, all of these people somehow feel that their lives were transformed. And that's why I was fascinated by the ritual, because it seems occult and it may seem silly, but clearly it has some lifelong effect on people who wield power in America.
Let's talk about what you did last weekend. Again, we're talking to Ron Rosenbaum, who is the author of The Secret Parts of Fortune, that includes the first expose of Skull and Bones. And we also, I want to ask you about asking the former President Bush in Air Force Two about Skull and Bones, but using high-tech night vision video equipment. Last weekend, you peered through the gloom into the inner courtyard of the Skull and Bones tomb in New Haven at the initiation ceremony?
Yeah, it was fascinating. I mean, you know, we had some intrepid members of the Yale community who had found a secret perch from which you could view the outside aspects of this ritual. And first of all, you can hear cries and whispers and screams as the initiates, who are called neophytes, are chased out of the inside of the tomb and harangued. And some of the things that they were harangued were are fairly interesting. They're indicative of the kind of character of that Skull and Bones inculcates. I mean, there was one of the Skull and Bones members administering the initiation who posed as George W. and who harangued the initiates obscenely. I mean, one of the things he said was, in a Texas drawl, "I'm going to ream you like I reamed Al Gore, and I'm going to kill you like I killed Al Gore." And there were other obscene insults. And then they mocked, or certainly made light of, the brutal assault on Abner Louima, because they were yelling out, "Take the plunger out of my ass." It seemed to me that these are sort of like privileged kids, so insulated in a way from the side of America that Abner Louima represented, that it's a little scary that they can turn this into a kind of joking initiation prank.
They also acted out the tableau of a throat-cutting ritual murder.
Yeah, this is what we actually published some still photos from the videotapes in the Observer this week, and it's fascinating. They first have to approach a kind of altar-like series of steps and kneel down and kiss a skull, after which they're face-to-face with these two people, one dressed like a sort of barbarian and the other lying on the ground. And the barbarian then mimes cutting the throat of the other person on the ground. So it's like this kind of savage tableau that's supposed to instill fear, or maybe it's supposed to instill comfort with cutthroat tactics. But it was fascinating to see the kind of psychodrama that's used to sort of disorient and bond them to this society.
And did you know who were the initiates this year?
Very interesting. Almost every year the names of the initiates are published. This year, for some reason, they didn't. And I wonder if it has something to do with the fact that George W., they now have another president in office, and maybe they're being a little more discreet.
Mm-hmm. And what about the rumor of Hitler's silverware being inside?
Well, there are all sorts of rumors. Skull and Bones is one of several secret societies at Yale, and there are all sorts of rumors about the various mementos and treasures, quote-unquote, that are inside. And one society, I think it's Scroll and Keys, which was the society of CIA master spy James Angleton, is the one that supposedly had Hitler's silverware. Skull and Bones is supposed to have the skulls of famous people, including the Native American Chief Geronimo, things like that. There was actually fascinating in the 70s. There was a group of women, when Skull and Bones was not co-ed and was refusing to admit women, actually broke in and published pictures of the interior. And in a way, if you look at these pictures, it's kind of silly. There are skulls all around and grandfather clocks and stuff like that. And so on the surface, it seems like this is just some, you know, occult mime show in a way. But it's not the surface so much. It's not the ritual surface or the tchotchkes inside. It's the lifelong bonds between people who exercise power and influence in America that makes Skull and Bones interesting.
In fact, isn't that what President George Bush told you, George Herbert Walker Bush?
Yeah, this was a strange encounter. I was covering he was vice president. I was covering a campaign swing he made, and we were aboard Air Force Two, the vice presidential plane. And I had some FaceTime with him, and I thought, all right, I'm going to ask him about Skull and Bones. And so I said, well, what is a Skull and Bones? Since members of Skull and Bones are supposed to leave the room when the name Skull and Bones is mentioned to avoid, you know, being trapped into having to talk about it. I thought, okay, now I've got him in the Air Force Two. He can't leave that room. You know, it's 35,000 feet down. So I said, well, what is it about the secret society? I mean, is it about leadership? And he said, well, no, it's not about leadership, really. It's about friendship. You know, I tried to press a little further. He clammed up, and I could see Barbara Bush sitting next to him, furiously jabbing her knitting needles into the fabric of whatever she was knitting, and almost as if she would have liked to have stabbed them into me. And I have to admit, I was a little intimidated by that, but I didn't think they were going to tell me much more anyway.
We're talking to Ron Rosenbaum, who is the author of The Secret Parts of Fortune. And in this week's New York Observer, he reveals for the first time having witnessed an initiation rite of the top secret society Skull and Bones at Yale University, what it was like. We'll come back with him. And when we're through with this conversation, we're going to talk about the Federalist Society, a radical right legal group that thrives in Washington, D.C., boasting some of the top Bush administration officials as its members. Stay with us. You're listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. For nearly a century and a half, Skull and Bones has been the most influential secret society in the nation, and now it is one of the last. It boasts among its initiates and members both Bushes, two presidents, former President George Bush and the current one. And now, for the first time, the initiation ceremony of this top secret society was actually video recorded with night video technology by Ron Rosenbaum, a reporter for the New York Observer, with a team of undergraduates. Who were the people who helped you do this, expose what was happening inside this tomb?
Well, I'm going to protect their confidentiality, but I have to say that, you know, I was impressed by these guys on my team because, you know, there's a lot of talk about how undergraduates, particularly at Ivy League colleges, are all careerists and they're all get along, go along, and they just want to suck up to power. And these were like, you know, really feisty kind of individuals who were skeptical and just the kind of people you kind of hope to see coming out of colleges rather than the kind of people who are just looking to, you know, find their niche in the power structure.
I know there are going to be some protests of the presidents who are there for the 300th anniversary of Yale this weekend, Clinton and Bush, and then a group of these protesters will be headed up to Quebec City afterwards to protest the FTAA, the Summit of the Americas that's taking place. But when the older Bush was a member of Skull and Bones, again, 15 members chosen a year, this is a society that didn't allow African Americans, didn't allow Jews, didn't allow women.
Yes. And as a matter of fact, they didn't allow women until I think it was like 1994. And there was one class in like 1990 when the initiates of that class wanted to admit women, wanted to tap women. And the Skull and Bones elders said they would shut them down and lock them out of the tomb if they dared to tap women for the society. Finally, in a closely contested vote, they did allow women members. But it's kind of interesting. You know, you would hope that women would, you know, sort of open things up and become, you know, less part of this kind of patriarchal structure. And yet, I was just yesterday, someone from The Observer was talking with a producer on, I think, one of the network magazine shows, Dateline, I think. And she said, well, I don't understand why this is important. And of course, it turns out she was a member of the secret society. The privileged people somehow believe that they got where they are just because of their own innate greatness. It had nothing to do with their connections or why, you know. She couldn't imagine that it was somehow interesting why so many members of this one society turn out to be presidents, secretaries of state, national security advisors, CIA people, heads of banks, brokerage houses. I mean, you know, for the privilege, the infrastructure of their privilege is invisible to them, and they're offended when someone from the outside looks at it and exposes it.
What about those ties to the CIA?
Well, it's interesting. You know, some of the founding members of the CIA were Skull and Bones people and members of other secret societies like James Angleton from Scroll and Key. And one of the things that's interesting is the habit of clandestinity. Secret societies are all about, you know, this sort of superstructure of code words and secret meetings and silence and all that, which fits quite well into intelligence operations. Here's an example of two people who were in Skull and Bones and were in the CIA. William F. Buckley, who was the founder of National Review, of course, and William Sloan Coffin, who was a kind of leftish protester, both in Skull and Bones, both went into the CIA. And one of the things I discovered recently in researching the Skull and Bones connections is that three of the four people who planned the Bay of Pigs were Skull and Bones members. And again, here's an example where the kind of ingrained habit of operating clandestinely, not being responsive to outside critiques or led America into an incredible disaster.
And they themselves call themselves spooks, right?
Yes, actually, yeah. The CIA term for a spy is spook, and spook is a Yale Secret Society. It came from Yale Secret Society slang.
And, of course, former President Bush was head of the CIA.
Exactly, yeah.
What about the other revelations that turned up in your night videotaping of the initiation last week?
Well, I can't repeat some of the obscene insults that were hurled at the initiates.
Why are you sworn to secrecy?
Well,
as well?
No, I mean, can I repeat them?
I'll beep you as you go.
Thought maybe the FCC might object, but we did learn the Skull and Bones death mantra. And it's so much of the Skull and Bones imagery is about death, and I think it has something to do with concentrating these young minds on mortality and the need to, you know, to adopt their life mission. But one of the things they repeat over and over in the initiation is this three-line death mantra: the hangman equals death, the devil equals death, death equals death. Now, I've studied that for hours, and I can't make heads or tails or why that's important, but clearly it has some real importance to them. And the emphasis on the hangman and death perhaps suggests a capital punishment theme that George W. might relate to. But it's somehow when you're taking young people of promise at that sort of vulnerable age and you're introducing them to extremely powerful elder people, in a way, it's I wouldn't say it's brainwashing, but in a way, it's sort of programming them to become part of the infrastructure of the establishment.
Ron Rosenbaum, what is the Russell Trust Association?
The Russell Trust Association is the shell corporation that runs Skull and Bones. It was named after General Russell, who was the founder. And they, in fact, changed their name recently, so it's more difficult for those who want to pursue the paper trail of their corporate boards to RTA Incorporated. But one of my researchers, Peggy Adler, was able to crack that code. And we also found very interesting kind of questions about the tax-exempt deductibility that the Russell Trust Association claims for itself, because it claims not to have any connection with any other exempt organization or any other organization at all, but in fact, they are interconnected with the Deer Island Corporation, which runs the Skull and Bones private island resort in the St. Lawrence River. And it just seems to me that if this is not George W.'s Whitewater, perhaps it's not, nonetheless, a scrupulous White House counsel ought to investigate what tax deductions are being claimed on behalf of George W. and these members, because it seems like there are questions that should be asked about this.
What is the tax status of the Skull and Bones?
It's a deductible tax-exempt organization, at least for federal taxes. For the local New Haven taxes, I believe they have to pay. But for a long time, they were exempt from all property taxes as well. Claims to be for the benefit of Yale University, but it's really only for the benefit of the members of Skull and Bones. And, you know, while I think Yale University has, you know, many luminous attainments to its credit, I just don't know whether, you know, what benefit the kind of initiation that mocks Abner Louima has to Yale University.
Did you ask any of the former graduates about, for example, those comments referring to Abner Louima, what the significance of this was?
You know, in the past, I was able to find out the names of the current Skull and Bones corporate officers, and I hand-delivered, messengered to them requests for comment and got none. And they're just unwilling to respond to the public.
So what do you conclude after your years of investigation, starting when you were an undergraduate who lived right across the street from Skull and Bones? They don't even open the door if someone isn't an initiate. You're not even allowed to see movement there.
I guess what I'd conclude is that, you know, everyone says that, well, the Eastern establishment is over and the kind of blue blood power network that once ruled America is over. And Skull and Bones was the center of it. But in fact, Skull and Bones has produced two presidents of the United States in the past decade. They've got Supreme Court justices. They have senators like John Kerry. The establishment lives and perpetuates itself not through some cabalistic conspiracy, but through the kind of wink and nod, informal bonds of kinship, solidarity that are formed through these rituals that we were finally the first to actually expose.
Well, people should check out your piece in the New York Observer this week, and also your book, The Secret Parts of Fortune, one of the chapters, The Last Secrets of Skull and Bones, in which we contemplate certain occult rituals of the ruling class. Ron Rosenbaum, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Amy.
Up next, we'll look at the Federalist Society. You're listening to Democracy Now!
Come l'altre verem per nostre spoglia, non per qualcuna sendre best, che non è giusto aver ciò compositore, qui le strascineremo a per la mesta serva, saranno i nostri corpi appesi, ciascuno al fondo l'ombra sonne resta. Avarice, hanging, self-destruction. Io feggi, io betami, le mie case. I make my own home, be my gallows.
You're listening to Democracy Now! The Federalist Society, a right-wing legal group, entered the radar screens of many Democrats and progressives around the time of the impeachment of former President Bill Clinton. Kenneth Starr, the independent counsel who led the Whitewater and Monica Lewinsky investigations, was active in the group, as well as many lawyers in his office and the lawyers who worked on the Paula Jones sexual harassment case. But under the Bush administration, the group has risen to unprecedented levels of power. Three cabinet secretaries are active supporters of the Federalist Society, John Ashcroft at Justice, Gail Norton at Interior, Spencer Abraham at Energy. During the first 100 days of his presidency, President Bush has dismantled workplace safety standards, reversed a campaign pledge on imposing new carbon dioxide emission standards, and says he plans to open up the Alaska National Wildlife Refuge to oil drilling. Members of the Federalist Society have also gained considerable influence in the legal arm of the administration. Ted Olson, the head of the group's Washington chapter, argued the Bush case in the Florida battle for the presidency last fall. He's now Solicitor General. And other members of the Society, including Larry D. Thompson, the Deputy Attorney General, are playing a central role in a 15-member special White House Justice Department committee picking candidates to fill two openings in the federal district and appeals courts. The Society won a major victory a few weeks ago when President Bush stripped the American Bar Association of its role in rating judicial candidates. Since 1996, the Society has published ABA Watch, documenting the American Bar Association's liberal stance on abortion, the death penalty, and gun control. The Federalist Society was formed 20 years ago by a handful of conservative law students who felt they were a beleaguered minority at their elite schools. For years, small chapters of the Society met on college campuses, trying to inject their right-wing ideas into the mainstream. Now the organization has a membership of 25,000. It has chapters in 60 cities, along with student chapters at 150 of the nation's 182 accredited law schools. Major supporters of the foundation include the John M. Olin Foundation, the Sarah Scaife Foundation, and the Lyndon Harry Bradley Foundation. We're joined now by Al Ross, who's president of the Institute for Democracy Studies, that just put out a big report on the Federalist Society that is also getting a good deal of attention in the mainstream papers in the last few days. But this report is called The Federalist Society and the Challenge to a Democratic Jurisprudence. Well, I've laid out some of its scope, but go farther, Al Ross, the significance of this.
Thank you very much, Amy. Well, the Federalist Society, which, as you mentioned, was set up in 1982, was established with a wide-ranging agenda by the leadership of the right wing of the legal groups in the United States. Its agenda is simply to transform every aspect of our democratic jurisprudence. The leadership includes people like Robert Bork, Ed Meese, Don Hodel of the Christian Coalition, and others, and have tens of thousands of members in major law firms across the country. Exemplifying the real agenda of the Federalist Society is Ted Olson, who, as you mentioned, has now been nominated by President Bush to be Solicitor General of the United States. It was Ted Olson who argued for reducing the sentence of LAPD cop Stacey Kuhn in the racist beating of Rodney King. It was Ted Olson who demolished affirmative action in Texas. And it was Ted Olson who argued the Virginia Military Institute case to ensure that that institution could discriminate against women. But more importantly, when Ted Olson argued Bush v. Gore in the Supreme Court of the United States, he wasn't just arguing to have Bush be president. What he was arguing for was to open the door for the full panoply of the agenda of the Federalist Society and the right-wing ideologues that it represents. And this agenda is significant indeed. Vertically, the Federalist Society is driving down through the Supreme Court, the federal courts, the administrative agencies, the law schools, and the American Bar Association itself. And as the right wing pushes its radical devolution agenda, the Federalist Society has recently set up a state judicial selection project in order to ensure that as they push power into the states, and particularly legal power into the states, basically a Wallace-side agenda, that they also have an ability to control the judicial apparatus at the state level and basically administer a checkmate to the entire judicial apparatus. On the federal courts, of course, both Scalia and Clarence Thomas have been leading activists in the Federalist Society. And Orrin Hatch, chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, has been a trustee of the Federalist Society for many, many years. It was Orrin Hatch who made the announcement a couple of years ago that he would no longer be inviting the American Bar Association to testify on important federal judicial appointments. Of course, it was the American Bar Association exercising its responsible, very mainstream purpose that refused to give the highest certification to Robert Bork, who was one of the really guiding spirits of the Federalist Society, and they never forgave the ABA for that. What happened recently, which received some attention in the press, is that the Bush administration decided that not only was the Judiciary Committee not going to hear the ABA, but the traditional role of the American Bar Association in providing preliminary screening of White House federal court appointments was also going to be handed over now to the Federalist Society. This is somewhat analogous to asking the Creationism Society to screen science teachers in high schools. So vertically, the Federalist Society is penetrating down and targeting every aspect of our legal institutions. Horizontally, they have an incredibly wide agenda as well, exemplified by the 15 practice groups that they've established, developing model legislation, analyzing laws, and publicizing extremely radical perspectives.
We have to break for stations to identify themselves. When we come back, we'll continue looking at this society, the Federalist Society, founded almost 20 years ago by a handful of right-wing law students, now boasting a membership of something around 25,000 with chapters in 60 cities and student chapters in a majority of the accredited law schools of this country, now boasting some of the top officials of the Bush administration. You're listening to Democracy Now! Back in a minute with Al Ross, president of the Institute for Democracy Studies. You're listening to Democracy Now! Free Speech Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. As we talk about the Federalist Society, membership in the group at law school has become an important credential for obtaining coveted clerkships with many conservative appeals court judges who in turn are able to promote some of those ideological protégés to clerkships at the Supreme Court. These jobs are greatly important in advancing to public policy positions. Reading from the New York Times, that piece yesterday, which is headlined, Al Ross, a conservative legal group thrives in Bush's Washington. Al Ross, our guest, is president of the Institute for Democracy Studies. What do you think of that headline? A conservative legal group thrives in Bush's Washington.
Well, there's no question that the second part of the statement is true. It's certainly not only thriving, it's actually directing the entire legal apparatus of this administration. But I think it's important for the American people to understand that Bork was not defeated because he was just conservative. Bork was defeated because his ideological agenda was an extremist agenda, even for the quite conservative American Bar Association.
Where is Bork today?
Bork, it's very interesting, Amy, it opens up the question that it's, of course, not just the Federalist Society. Bork has recently joined the faculty of a new law school set up by Tom Monahan, the founder and owner of Domino's Pizza. In addition to the Federalist Society, which is actually the most important of the right-wing legal institutions striving to restructure our legal system, there's been a proliferation across the country over the recent period of other right-wing legal institutions. In law schools, of course, there's Tom Monahan's Ave Maria with Bork on the faculty.
The law school is called Ave Maria.
It's called Ave Maria. Tom Monahan of Domino's Pizza, as some of you may know, had been one of the leaders of a right-wing Catholic cult that bound women that weren't in submission to their husband's authority and went on from there. Pat Robertson himself has a law school, and both Scalia and Clarence Thomas have spoken there on a number of occasions. Additionally, there are a number of right-wing secular institutions, like the Institute for Justice and the Center for Individual Rights, which are litigating across the country a range of important issues, supplemented by Christian right-wing legal groups, like the Christian Legal Society and others. So while the Federalist Society, which includes the right-wing libertarian input, as well as people like Don Hodel from the Christian right, there are a number of other institutions which work collaboratively, not necessarily monolithically, to shape the agenda.
Al Ross, you were talking before the break about the 15 practice groups of the Federalist Society.
Yes. Well, the breadth and agenda of the Federalist Society is exemplified by the practice groups, which we discuss in our briefing paper, The Federalist Society and the Challenge to a Democratic Jurisprudence, which people can obtain by contacting us through our website at www.idsonline.org or calling our office at 212-423-9237. But these practice groups provide an opportunity for the Federalist Society to display the extremism of their agenda. The practice groups range from everything from environmental law, civil rights, federal court structures, and so on. A recent issue of the Corporations and Securities Practice Group newsletter of the Federalist Society had a front-page story advocating the abolition of the SEC. Their views are similar, needless to say, for the Environmental Protection Agency. And it's interesting to note that Gail Norton, the new secretary for the Interior, had actually her portfolio, although it's been articulated to take care of the air, she was actually a member of the criminal law division of the Federalist Society. And giving her a portfolio to demolish the environmental laws actually put at the cabinet table one of the top advocates of the Federalist Society, strengthening their input at that level. But one of the most important aspects of the Federalist Society practice group agenda is exemplified in their civil rights practice group, where one of their lead people who they tout around the country is a fellow named Clint Bolick of the Institute for Justice. Clint Bolick published an important book on affirmative action called The Affirmative Action Fraud, which was published in 1996 and is probably the most important book of the right wing attacking affirmative action with the coy ploy that affirmative action discriminates against white Christian males. What most people don't realize, although his attack on affirmative action is problematic enough, is that several years before that, Bolick published another book called Unfinished Business, A Civil Rights Strategy for America's Third Century. This book was actually a task force product of a number of extremely right-wing legal advocates representing a number of the organizations that I mentioned earlier. The giveaway for the extremism of Bolick and the civil rights practice group that he basically represents is that the foreword to the book for the civil rights strategy for this century was written by Charles Murray, author of The Bell Curve, which is the leading publication which validated a basically racialist analysis that black people were genetically inferior to whites. Behind the radical deregulation and civil rights, anti-civil rights agenda of the Federalist Society is this netherworld of extremism. Where they will go on this is unclear, but certainly it's going not only after air, women, nuclear disarmament, and so on, but as they gradually gain increasing authority and control of the federal court system, the ability to contain this extreme agenda is going to be dramatically diminished.
Al Ross, who is Attorney James Bopp Jr.?
James Bopp Jr. is a very interesting example of the sort of spider in the web of right-wing advocacy organizations. James Bopp is the head of the elections subcommittee of the Free Speech and Elections Committee of the Federalist Society. He has served as the general counsel of the Christian Coalition and the National Right to Life Committee, as well as representing the National Rifle Association itself. The organizations that Bopp has represented have been some of the key organizations opposed to electoral campaign reform. And so between Bopp's operations blocking campaign reform,
not campaign finance,
campaign finance reform, and Olson's litigation at the Supreme Court, they're trying through a number of different avenues to ensure right-wing control of not only the legal but the political apparatus of this country.
And what is Bopp's connection to President Bush?
Bopp is representing, he's not directly yet tied to Bush, but he's one of these important forces around Bush that are nurturing this administration and shaping its agenda.
When we watch television and the talking heads on television, they're rarely identified, or even the groups that they're with are rarely identified for the funding they get, et cetera. But can you give us the landscape of some of the groups, like the Institute for Justice you just mentioned with Clint Bowlick, Washington Legal Foundation, Center for Individual Rights, Pacific Legal Foundation, how they're connected, and also to the Federalist Society?
Sure. We published in December of 1999 another briefing paper called The Assault on Diversity: Behind the Challenges to Racial and Gender Remedies, which was basically an analysis of the organizations opposed to affirmative action and other efforts to ensure diversity. At the back of this publication is a chart of the integrated structures of the institutions that the right wing has developed to turn back the clock on the gains since Brown v. Board of Education. At the top of this chart, we've identified several major foundations, Bradley, Olin, and SCAFE, huge foundations of hundreds of millions of dollars, which provide the coordination necessary to integrate the various agendas of the right wing. Most of the organizations on the legal right receive funding from one or all of those organizations, ensuring that at the top there's this level of coordination. For example, if one were to look at the board of directors of the Richard Mellon SCAFE Foundation, one would find Ed Fuelner, president of the Heritage Foundation, and the enormous agenda and role they play in Washington, as well as T. Kenneth Cribb, who's the general counsel for the Federalist Society, which, as I mentioned earlier, is coordinating a wide-ranging agenda on the legal front.
And what about Ken Starr? All know him as the famous prosecutor of President Clinton, but exactly his connections to the Federalist
Society. Well, Ken Starr has been heavily involved in the Federalist Society for some time, and so have a number of his aides who are now playing an increasing role in the White House counsel's office. So if one were to look at the range of individuals and institutions that over the years since the Reagan administration, where a number of them were brought into and credentialized in the Civil Rights Division, so-called, of the Justice Department, one sees them now spreading out through these litigating organizations, through the administration, and so on, shaping the agendas both in the public debate and in the institutions. And I should say in the law schools, for example, where the Federalist Society is now in many law schools the most important student organization at 140 law schools across the country, they recently set up a faculty division. So between the student and faculty division, they're effectively beginning to shape the parameters of the debate in the law schools. On our side, we felt it was important to try to engage the agenda of the right in the law schools, and our institute has begun setting up law and democracy projects in several law schools. And we're proud that the Columbia Law School project of the Institute is being spearheaded by Jack Greenberg, who argued Brown v. Board.
Hmm. We had hoped to get Eugene Meyer on the program, who is executive director of the Federalist Society. We weren't successful. But in a photograph of him in the Times, it shows him keeping a portrait of the Federalist hero James Madison on his Washington office wall. Where did the Federalist Society get its name?
Well, they got their name from the Federalist Society. It's a free country, and they can call themselves whatever they want. Of course, their agenda is profoundly anti-federalist. And they've, over the years, developed a facility for adopting the vocabulary of the civil rights movement, calling arguing against affirmative action by saying it discriminates, calling their organizations cute-sounding names like Center for Individual Rights and so on. The challenge for the American people now is to begin to look beneath the surface, to get a hold of some of the materials that we and others have published, and educate themselves about the nature of these challenges, because fortunately their real agenda is so marginal to the interests of most American people that we believe if we can effectively expose it, we can contain their effect.
We're going to have a continued discussion next week that goes beyond the Federalist Society, but looks to, and I want to ask you, how central the issue of abortion is to the Federalist Society. And next week, we're going to explore with you Priests for Life, which is going to be the subject of a fundraiser on Wednesday next week in New York, and there's going to be a major protest outside. But how is Priests for Life tied in here?
Priests for Life is now emerging as one of the most important anti-abortion organizations in the nation. Founded by a New York, Staten Island-based priest, Catholic priest, Father Frank Pavone, it has now rapidly grown and announced 2 weeks ago a $12 million coast-to-coast campaign to lobby against choice. What's significant about Pavone is he bridges the highest levels of Vatican global policy to the lowest levels of right-wing extremist anti-abortion activism. On April 25th, at a gala black tie $500 a plate dinner at the New York Waldorf Astoria, Father Frank Pavone, who has explicitly justified criminal trespass against abortion clinics and encouraged blockades of clinic doors, is going to be receiving a gala award from the National Right to Life Committee, the largest anti-choice organization in the nation, with chapters in every state across the country and a major international outreach as well. Since 1994, the National Right to Life Committee has received nearly $1 million from the Republican Party and Republican Party allied institutions. What's happening here is that an organization calling for clinic blockades and justifying criminal trespass is getting a national award. And what's developing around and with the encouragement of the climate generated by this administration is the potentiality for a dramatic rise of anti-abortion violence. Frank Pavone has very close ties to Joe Shidler, who was charged by a jury recently with over 100 violations of the Federal Racketeering Act. And so in addition to the very important march in Washington this coming Sunday, in New York City at 5:30 outside the Waldorf Astoria will be what may well be one of the largest pro-choice demonstrations in the past decade.
Father Pavone has an interesting quote, which is, "Separation of church and state does not mean separation of God and state." If people want to get a hold of your reports on the Federalist Society, on the global assault on reproductive rights, and other such studies, again, where can they phone?
Our telephone number is 212-423-9237, and our website is www.idsonline.org.
I want to thank you very much for being with us, Al Ross. We'll continue the discussion next week. President of the Institute for Democracy Studies, former head of international national research at the
Planned Parenthood Federation.
Planned Parenthood Federation of America. That does it for the program. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams and Terry Allen. Anthony Sloan is our engineer. If you want to write to us, you can send us mail at email@democracynow.org. That's mail@democracynow.org. From the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of The Band and The Fired, from the studios of our listeners, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Democracy Now!